From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. This week, Soundings presents excerpts from conversations with two contemporary American writers of fiction and nonfiction. My guests are Gail Godwin, the author of 6 novels and 2 collections of short stories, and Robert Coles, a child psychiatrist and the author of 2 recent books about the moral and political lives of children. First on Soundings this week, a discussion with Gail Godwin, whose most recent novels are The Finishing School and A Mother and 2 Daughters. I asked Gail Godwin to reflect on her own fiction and its relation to English and American literary tradition.
Well, when I began to write, I thought I was utterly original and that nobody had ever existed who wrote about the things I wrote about and the way I wrote about them. The more I write and the more I read, the more I realize out of what tradition I do come.
And which is that?
I think the English, the British, people like from Jane Austen to D.H. Lawrence, writers who are interested primarily in interactions between people, mm-hmm. in characters who have an intense mental life, in characters who worry a lot about how to live. Mm-hmm. This is important to them. I'm mostly concerned with character and how characters make their way through the world they've been given, mm-hmm. and how they balance between being shaped by that world and imposing themselves back on it. And there's quite a balance there. If you mm-hmm. don't balance right, you go under or you become a megalomaniac, mm-hmm. One or the other.
Give me an example. I'm thinking, of the young woman who narrates, what is it called, The Angry Year? She goes off to college and she just gets really upset with
yes.
some of the people she sees around her. Maybe you could tell me about her or pick a character.
Well, I'll talk about her. Jane in The Angry Year. It's mm-hmm. a college story. It's written from the point of view of retrospect, when the heroine is older and wiser. The girl goes off to college, or we should say the woman goes off to college now, and she is torn. She has a personality which is pretty much divided equally between wanting to be a rebel and wanting to conform, mm-hmm. and it almost tears her apart.
Well, Gail Godwin, what was going on in this story? Why did you feel, compelled to write it at the time that you did, The Angry Year?
Well, because this is really a story about an enemy, only the enemy lives inside of you. Mm. And I had to locate a time in my life when that enemy was still unknown to me. And that's sometimes when the enemy is strongest, it's before you know what the enemy is. And it took the writing of the story, it took putting the story into the words that I put it into for me to understand that indeed this enemy still lives in me, mm-hmm. and as the story says, she still keeps quarters for herself in some unreachable part of my psyche. It's a part of yourself that you don't want to acknowledge. Maybe it's a cowardly part or a brutal part. Often what we do before we acknowledge it, we go around projecting it on other people. Mm-hmm. And that's what Jane does in this story. When she goes off to college, she looks around and she locates a certain kind of people that she hates. And these are all conformists. They're all people in sororities. They all dress alike. Their clothes infuriate her, and yet she wears those clothes, too.
She's drawn to them.
They both fascinate her and repel her.
She's got a boyfriend who runs one of the fraternities.
She manages to get herself the president of a fraternity, and then she sits there every weekend at the fraternity and says ugly things about fraternities and sororities. And they're all just fascinated with her, too, because she's such an outsider, and yet she's in their midst. So she has it both ways for a while, until, well, then the story complicates itself with other characters.
Let's talk about another story in this collection, which is to say Mr. Bedford and the Muses.
Yes.
First, a very general question, Gail Godwin. Who are your muses? At the end of this collection, for example, you have a little postscript where you talk about where ideas come from to writers, and where they get them. What about you? Where, when you sort of sit there staring at the blank page, how does it occur?
A muse can be just about anything. It can be a it can be a memory. It can be a an agonizing over some shortcoming you yourself have, or something in your own character you don't understand, and then you decide you'll put it in somebody else and send them off through life and see what happens to them.
Do they announce themselves, these muses, or do they sort of sneak up on you and you'll say to yourself, whoa, there's something there for a story or a novel? How does that work?
My muses, by their very nature, are unpredictable. Usually if I'm looking for one, it's nowhere to be found. I knew a painter once who said to me, I go to my study every day, and most days nothing happens. But what if I didn't go one day, and that day the angel chose to come and said, where is he?
And that happens to you?
So I go. At the moment, I don't have that problem because I'm working on a long novel, and it's all I can do just to hold all the strands in my head. But between novels and stories, there's sometime a period when nothing announces itself, and I'll sometimes try to force it, and that usually doesn't work. I can force it because I have a lot of discipline. I can fight my way through a story, but it might not be a very inspired story.
Mm-hmm. What are your literary concerns? Is it possible to talk as rather crudely and generally at the same time as that? When you sit down for a new project, which itself would be, I suppose, another tale, how does that happen? Is it, do you work, that is, from the experiences and the characters and let the generalities sort of take care of themselves, or do you bring the generalities to the specifics?
Well, there's no one rule. The book I'm writing now, I had to know the form it was going to be in first. And luckily that came fairly quickly. Again, it was almost a visual picture in my mind. I saw that it would have at least 12 chapters, that the chapters would have to be long, that it would take place within the time framework of 1 year, but of course there would be a lot of going back in time, that the chapters would be given to different points of view, but several of the chapters would have several points of view. I have to find my ground rules first, the setup that will be best for this book. So it's very conscious questions of craft and how you're going to build a work, especially a long work.
Gail Godwin, we're talking about your life as a writer. You are a novelist. You've written many novels, a couple of collections of short stories. We have a good bit of discussion today, particularly in the academic circles, about the connections. Well, there's always been discussion about politics and literature, ideological concerns. We have feminism is very much on the literary scene these days. Are those what concerns of yours? How do you figure those things out as you do your books?
Well, I'm concerned with politics. I'm concerned with feminism. I don't take big chunks of them and push them into my writing like some awkward ingredient and try to mash it in with it. If politics come into my books, it's because a character is concerned. For instance, in A Mother and Two Daughters, we have Kate, who is very much against the Vietnam War, so she leads her class of little girls to block the Lincoln Tunnel. That's something that she does. I'm not speaking through her. It's something that she cares about. So I try to let my characters choose how political they want to be, or that kind of thing.
Was it Hemingway who said that he felt bad after a while because he killed off one of his characters and he missed the old boy, something like that? Does that sort of thing happen to you? Do you, live inside of them, or they in you, and do you miss them when the books are over? Do you still talk to them and carry their lives on? How does that work?
I sometimes miss them. I was very sorry to kill a dog and a mother and two daughters, and I really hated myself for doing it. It had to be done.
Mm-hmm.
But I was most offended with myself when I did that. When I finished the finishing school, for some reason I missed Ursula Devane, that fascinating older woman who may or may not have been a terrible liar. And what I found myself doing a couple of months after I finished the book, I would play act Ursula when I would go to a party where I thought I'd be bored or something. I thought, well, I'll just see if I can be Ursula tonight.
Uh-huh.
And it was fun.
Does that happen often? I mean, do you sort of act out your characters and the dialogue? Let's pause on dialogue, for instance. Mm-hmm. How do you cook that up?
Well, I don't cook it up. What I try to do is, if I'm imagining two people talking,
mm-hmm.
Sometimes I even close my eyes. I have to imagine where they are, the setting, and then I have to imagine exactly how they would speak. And then I have to do a little literary trick, otherwise it would go on for pages and pages. I have to make it seem as if it were a natural dialogue, just the way people really talk. But I have to abbreviate it,
mm-hmm.
and make sure that what's said either reveals character or furthers the story.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I hear them. I try to hear them,
mm-hmm.
what someone would naturally say.
Gail Godwin, let's conclude our conversation. We've been talking about your fiction. Let me ask you to step back and tell me, why do you think that it's important that in a country like America, which is a popular culture, a democratic society, why should we have fiction? What might its function be? Do you think of it in terms of aesthetic sort of goals? You said, for instance, earlier that you don't think of yourself as teaching, as didactic. Mm-hmm. How do you go about addressing a question like that? Is it important to you?
Oh, I think fiction is crucial to a culture, because what you get are many different individual visions of that culture.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you get such different visions as, say, the black humor of Kurt Vonnegut and the let's see, what would the other extreme? Then you get a very domestic vision, internal and domestic, say, in the young writer Rob Foreman Dew.
Mm-hmm.
You get a angry vision. You get a hopeless vision. You get a thoughtful vision. You get all of them, and they're all contained in stories,
mm-hmm.
which are fun to read.
And what kind of an adjective would you put in front of Gail Godwin's vision? Is there one that...
Maybe that's not for me to say. I would have to think about it for a long time.
Gail Godwin is the author of 6 novels and 2 collections of short stories. Her most recent novels are The Finishing School and A Mother and 2 Daughters, published by Viking Press. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Following my discussion with Gail Godwin, Soundings now turns to current American nonfiction. Here is an excerpt from a conversation with Robert Coles of Harvard University. Dr. Coles is a child psychiatrist, whose most recent books are The Moral Life of Children and The Political Life of Children, both published by Atlantic Monthly Press. Over a 10-year period, Robert Coles talked to children in the United States, Brazil, South Africa, and Poland.
Well, what I've been trying to figure out is how do children get their moral values, and, mm-hmm. and even more important, how do they live up to those moral values, and indeed do they live up to those moral values? as you may know, there are a lot of people who have moral values who don't necessarily live up to them.
Mm-hmm.
But I started this work in the South in the early 1960s when children were going through the intense struggle over school desegregation. Much of that now no longer a problem in America because the Southern schools perhaps are better integrated in certain respects than Northern schools. But in any event, what I came to observe is children going through a real time of severe social and racially connected stress with all sorts of mobs and difficulties to experience, including even boycotts by the white population of the schools. And I got to know the black children going through this kind of stress and, of course, the white children, some of whom were kept out of school. What I became impressed with over time was the intense moral struggles of some of these children, as black children were being cursed and threatened with death, and in some instances, hard to believe, I would find children facing this kind of terrible, terrible stress and praying for the people who were threatening them.
Do you think, Dr. Coles, our topic is the moral and political life of children. Is there a moral life, intrinsic to children? In a way, you're talking here about the nature of human nature. At the same time, you're discussing what we bring to the sort of blank slate and write upon it. How do you make those distinctions?
Well, I don't think that there is an inherited moral life in the sense that children could be, and sometimes unfortunately they are, quite amoral, depending really on the family life and the neighborhood life and the national life and the historical moment. Here was a little girl who came from a family that didn't have much in the way of education. The parents didn't even know how to sign their name, so I suppose we'd have to call them functionally illiterate. But they were intensely religious and moral people in their everyday lives, and I was enormously impressed by the way they were bringing up their children to be moral, teaching them how to pray, teaching them how to reflect morally, teaching them the precepts that they had in turn learned from both the Old and the New Testaments. And in that sense, what I witnessed was a family's moral life being transmitted to the children. Now, I have seen other families, and I'm sure many Americans know what I'm talking about, where the children have lacked this kind of moral instruction. And when children lack this over a number of years, I don't know whether they can ever get it once they're adults. And my purpose is not to judge them so much as to understand where they get their values and what they believe in and what their ideals are and what's the origins of those ideals in their home life, in their school life, in their Boy Scout or Girl Scout life, in their neighborhood gang life, in the kind of values they get from teachers, from scoutmasters, from coaches, from friends, all the roots of moral life, so to speak, in a child's life.
Well, be anecdotal for me. Tell me about a particular instance, as it were, a case study.
I'll tell you of a particular American child in Florida whose father is one of the wealthiest growers in the state. And who employed many migrant farm workers on his land. And this couple, this man and his wife, had one son who was 8 years old when we first met him. And my wife's a school teacher, and my wife and I got to know this grower and his wife very well, and they're very fine people. One day, the wife of the grower told my wife that the principal of the school where their son went had called them up because the boy, then in the third grade, in the course of a classroom discussion on what he wanted to be when he grew up, had told the teacher that he didn't think he wanted to be too rich. And the teacher said, "What do you mean by that?" And the boy said, "I don't want to be too rich." And the teacher said, "Why?" And the boy said, "Well, because if I'm too rich, I won't get into heaven."
Right.
And the teacher said, "Where did you get that idea?" And the boy said, "In Sunday school and from the Bible." And the teacher said, "What do you mean?" And the boy said, "Well, in the Bible it says it'll be harder for a rich man to get into heaven, as hard for that to happen as for a camel to go through the eye of a needle." And the teacher was stunned. And then she started to try to tone that down in the boy's mind, because she said, look, it's true, it does say that in the Bible, but you must not take this so personally, mm-hmm. and you must not get so upset about it, because the boy clearly was upset about it. And then the teacher became worried after this discussion, because she thought, well, what are all these parents going to think when we're having this kind of discussion in the class? So she told the principal, who called up the mother. Now, it was very interesting what the mother of this boy thought. Tells us a lot about American society, secular society. The mother said to the principal, don't worry about it. My son's going through a stage. Now, what did she mean by that? I asked her. I said, what do you mean your son's going through a stage? She said, well, Johnny's only about 8 or 9 now, and he plays with a lot of migrant children. He's influenced by them, but he'll outgrow that, and pretty soon he won't be playing with those kids, and he'll forget these ideas. Isn't that interesting? Well, I'll tell you what happened. A year later, the boy was still preoccupied with this and still worried about it, and by this time the family had begun to worry, and they took him to a local pediatrician who had a long talk with the boy and asked him why he was so worried about being rich and why he was taking that Bible so seriously. The net result of it was that this boy ended up seeing a child psychiatrist who helped him to forget about such matters. Now that's a moral fable of sorts. But it would be nice, really, if we practiced what we preached a little bit, mm-hmm. or maybe a little more often than we even think to do. That mm-hmm. would be a beginning for us as parents and for our children. Mm-hmm. It's awfully hard sometimes. I talk with children, and they tell me that they hear one thing at home 1 minute, and then they hear that very principle contradicted by the very parents who told him about it, or the teacher or the neighbor, in the interests of what? In the interests of going along with mm-hmm. things as they are, or getting along with the world and all of its mm-hmm. demands. And at a certain point, I think there's a loss there, a tremendous moral loss.
Dr. Robert Coles, our topic is, you have two new books, The Political Life of Children, The Moral Life of Children. Can we say that politics is an extension of individual morality? If that is true, let's assume that it is for the purposes of our conversation, how would you characterize the political life of children? Again, I'd like you to be anecdotal for me.
Well, I think, for me at least, out of my own ignorance and innocence, I didn't think that children had a political life for a uh-huh. long time. The first time I discovered that children had a political life was when I was a resident at the Children's Hospital in Boston and learning to be a child psychiatrist. I'd taken training in pediatrics, and then I went on into child psychiatry. And I'll never forget a little boy whom I was treating who came to my office wearing an Eisenhower button.
I like Ike.
Right. And we got into a conversation about his home life. And then he said, you know, I've noticed that a lot of the doctors around here are wearing Stevenson buttons. Stevenson was the Democratic candidate running right. against Eisenhower. Maybe not all the listeners right. here will remember that far back.
Now, this was the kid who said
this
that he noticed.
This was the kid. And I said, that. Oh, really? And then he proceeded to give me the most astonishing lecture on the difference between Eisenhower voters and Stevenson voters.
Well, in a larger sense, Dr. Robert Coles, what you're saying is that children are much more sophisticated than traditionally we have given them credit for being, both in a political and in a moral sense.
You bet. And isn't it interesting, in this century we've learned through psychiatry and the culture which is so preoccupied with psychology, we've learned to give children credit for infinite sophistication on matters of family life, sexuality, aggressiveness. They're very sophisticated. They're quite grown up. They have all sorts of sophistications in those realms. But we don't give them credit for either moral or political sophistication. We think of them as being rote-like and obedient and mm-hmm. taking their values only from what they hear a particular parent say, which, by the way, is not necessarily true.
Well, what do we do to begin to learn from them? That must sound terribly naive to you, but at the same time, I get the sense that you are urging that upon your readers and people who are listening to this discussion.
Well, that certainly is the implicit moral judgment in both books, that it would be nice if we would pay more attention to our children and learn from them, because I think there's an enormous amount they have to teach us if we would only pay heed and allow them to be our teachers.
Dr. Robert Coles, let's conclude our conversation. You have just published a couple of books here on the political and moral life of children. Let me ask you to be very personal. What political or moral lesson, maybe that's a term that's a little too grandiose. What have you learned? Be very specific for me and tell me something that you have picked up from your investigations into the political or moral life of children that stays with you, that has had a personal impact upon you.
Well, what stays with me is the sight of children, say, in Northern Ireland or in South Africa, fighting hard on behalf of certain principles and values that they believed to be important. Catholic children fighting for more rights for the Catholic people there. Black children in South Africa trying to assert their people's dignity. This can be very impressive, as it was in the American South and, in fact, in the American North during the civil rights struggles of the 60s and 70s, to watch children shouldering the moral and political struggles of a particular society is always very poignant and very impressive to contemplate. Beyond that, I have been struck over the years as I've worked with children, and I've described this again and again in those two books. I describe in those books the ways that children take stock morally of the world and keep struggling again and again to make this a better world in the playground, in the classroom. Some of the poignant statements that these children make, the questions they ask too about why isn't this a better world and why don't people treat one another better and why are people hungry while other people have so very much. These are the old questions that the Hebrew prophets used to ask, that Jesus and his disciples asked, and that I think all of us ought to keep on asking throughout our lives. And to hear children asking these questions the way Isaiah and Jeremiah and Amos did and the way Jesus did, whether they be black or white or American or South African or Irish or Polish, whether they be girls or boys, rich or poor, is to be reminded that that's what human beings are. We are the creature on this planet who has language at our beck and call and who uses language to ask questions about the nature of the world. And you see that in children when they start to be 2-3 years old and start talking. They ask whys. They want to know, and that is the beginning of their moral life and of their political life. And it's very impressive to watch that developing in any child, regardless of where the child's living.
Robert Coles is a child psychiatrist at Harvard University. His most recent books are The Moral Life of Children and The Political Life of Children, published by Atlantic Monthly Books. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Contemporary American Fiction and Nonfiction, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, a conversation with Carl Hagler, director of the Adult Literacy Initiative at the United States Department of Education. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Listen to Soundings. This is Kim Nielsen at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join Wayne Pond this week for conversations about two prominent American writers of fiction and nonfiction. Novelist Gail Godwin discusses her own work and its relationship to English and American literary tradition. Robert Coles, a child psychiatrist, talks about his recent books on the moral and political lives of children. Current American fiction and nonfiction. This week on Soundings, from the National Humanities Center, on this station,